we work on soil biodiversity and functioning. So that means like we look at who is in the soil and what are they doing.
That's Dr. Siska Veen, soil and ecosystems researcher at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology.
So actually, we're just fools if we don't use these soils in a proper way.
And that's soil and ecosystems researcher Dr. Wim van der Putten, who heads terrestrial ecology at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. Hi, and welcome to Conversations with Scientists. I'm Vivian Marks. Today's episode digs into dirt, or rather, as it is scientifically called, soil. Traditionally, as Wim van der Putten has mentioned to me, soil science is mostly physics and chemistry and not about the critters in the soil, like invertebrates or microbes. For soil ecologists, on the other hand, which Dr. van der Putten and Dr. Veen are, it's all about soil and its organisms, including microbes. And there are around 5,000 microbial species in a teaspoon of soil. There have been some separations between soil scientists and soil ecologists, but in many cases, soil studies involve physics and chemistry and ecology and biology. I asked both of the scientists a number of things, such as how to measure if soil is healthy and how might soils store more CO2. There is a balance to strike to make soil sustainable and for the long term able to produce the food we need. And since in many areas of the world soil is damaged, they talked about how one can restore it. And yes, I did also talk about gardening tips. I wrote a story for Nature Methods about soil, and I wanted to share more of what I heard, so this is how this podcast came to be. I always like asking people about their name, also so I can maybe sort of pronounce it kind of right. So Dr. Veen explains her name, since I also wondered about the two initials, GF, in her scientific publications.
So my name is Siska Veen, and the letters are actually not in the middle of the name, but my second name is actually Franciska. GF are my only initials, but everybody calls me Siska. People know me by Siska, that's fine. And I use like my initials for publications, but yeah, nobody knows me by those really. So
it's Wim van der Putten. If you would put it in the American way, it's Wim van der Putten. Van der in Dutch is like, if you would say, of the. Put is just a source or a well. So it's of the sources.
Wim van der Putten and a number of soil scientists and soil ecologists published a perspective in Science a while ago called Soil Biodiversity Needs Policy Without Borders. It's about the way soil is connected globally and how important soil biodiversity is. A link to this perspective is in the show notes. I found that concept of global connection a bit puzzling. How might soil be globally connected? It's because producing food drags nutrients around the world.
So we wanted to reach a broader audience and then see how they could be made aware of the importance of soil for everything that is just happening in life. So for the way how we can adapt to climate change and what we are doing actually for producing food in terms of dragging around nutrients across the world, carbon, and just making a huge footprint, but also by reducing the nutrients in one continent, for example, in South America, to overload the nutrient condition in another part of the world, in Northwestern Europe. So in the EU, for a long time, they didn't have a soil policy because they said, well, what does a soil in Spain have to do with a soil in the Netherlands?
Spain and the Netherlands aren't, geographically speaking, neighbors, but there is a soil connection between them, which wasn't clear to policymakers.
And this is the politicians, especially in the national politicians. We have learned in ecology is that ecosystems can be connected. For example, there's a famous example of swans going from, or geese going from the Midwest in the United States to the Canadian coastal region. So because they are not being controlled in the winter when they feed in the Midwest, there's too many of these geese going to the Arctic, and there they overgraze the wetlands in northeastern Canada. So and this type of examples is quite prominent in ecology, where you see that disconnected locations can be connected through these types of processes like transport or movement or so.
When we spoke, I mentioned the fires in Canada, which showed the eastern seaboard of the United States how connected that area is to an area that seems far away. The forest fires in Canada led to this orange fog all across the eastern seaboard, and it smelled like burnt wood and made your throat scratchy and your eyes water.
I saw the orange on the pictures, yes, and this is an interesting type of feedback that I am interested in also, because these feedbacks are much more real than we realize. You would assume that climate change is influenced, for example, more in regions like where New York is, where many people are living and using a lot of energy. Then it changes the climate, and as a consequence, more northern territories become more prone to fire because of drought. And then the fire gives smoke, and that smoke goes back to the east coast of the United States. Then it's sort of a boomerang effect. You throw out a boomerang and you get it back. It's hitting you.
Global connections in soil science can boomerang in interesting ways. Wow. Soil science, as I learned reporting this story, is not classically about biology or ecology.
Soil science classically is the ones who look at the physics and chemistry. So let's say how the house is constructed. And soil ecologists, we look at the inhabitants of the house. So what are the microbes, the nematodes, the earthworms doing? And actually, there is a direct connection between physics, chemistry, and soil ecology. So ecology is actually the relationship between living organisms and their abiotic environment, so their physical environment, but also to their biological environment. So we look specifically at the organisms in soil, and the physicists and chemists look at the dead components in soil. But the dead components of soil, so which is like the walls and the roof of your house, they influence who can live there, but who will live there influences how the house is looking like. So actually there should be a constant interaction between physics, chemistry, and biology, but these are sort of living apart together.
Living apart together. It sounds like there should be interactions between researchers in physics, chemistry, and biology related to soil, but these do not always happen. Besides bringing disciplines together to get a better picture of what is happening in soil, scientists need to decide on scale of their research. They might look at soil in a pot, or on a much larger scale like a field, or in a controlled environment called an ecotron. The idea is to try and draw conclusions about what is happening in the scale you are studying, and then try to extrapolate from that. The different scales take different levels of effort and time and money. At the Netherlands Institute of Ecology, the team does experiments at all the scales. Here's Siska Veen.
We do all of it. Yeah, so we do experiments all the way up from like really small scale stuff in the lab where we have things in vials, up to micro and mesocosm, so those are sort of soils in small to big pots, basically, up to the field. So we work on soil biodiversity and functioning, so that means like we look at who is in the soil and what are they doing in terms of nutrient cycling, carbon storage, cycling water, greenhouse gas emissions, like all those kind of things. And we measure that across all these type of experiments, basically.
In soil research, you can go small, go big, and work in something called ecotrons, which are larger controlled environments, and we'll talk about those in this episode too. Different scales get you different types of experiments and insights from those experiments.
There's a few nice things about going small scale and a few nice things about going big scale. So small scale means that you have a lot of control, so you can manipulate specific factors very precisely. And that can be very nice if you want to untangle what the impact of a certain factor is. The disadvantage is that you're at some point not working in a real soil or a real ecosystem anymore, because you basically, there's two things for soil specifically. One is you are sort of destroying the structure of a soil. So a real soil is layered, and if you take it to like your small tube, you lose that basically. And all the connections with other species are gone, right? On the big scale. So that's why we also do a lot of measurements in the field, because there you can measure in the real system with all this variation, all these interactions, and this layering of the soil, which is actually really important for a lot of processes like the transport of water, for example. It's just determined by physics of the soil. But then you don't have so much control anymore because there's a lot of variation and you miss out on like untangling very specific factors sometimes. We, of course, do manipulative experiments in the field, but it just becomes harder. So ecotrons are a bit of the maybe link between these very controlled experiments and fields, because they actually, yeah, they can have real soils, they can have multiple species interacting. You can manipulate stuff because usually they're built in a controlled environment or the backyard of an institute, something like that. Yeah, they're still not the real world, but they're already quite close to it, while having some advantages that small-scale experiments have. But because of that, let's say the scale of the ecotrons and the possibility that you can still manipulate and measure things really well means that they're usually very expensive. Also, that they're very big, so that you can only have, and that's a large disadvantage of ecotrons, that you can only have a few, which means that you do not have a lot of power to manipulate either a lot of factors or do a lot of replicates. So you basically repeat your setup a few times, let's say. That's what we usually do in small-scale experiments or the field.
Ecotrons are larger and more expensive to maintain and use, and there aren't many of them. I spoke to a few scientists about their ecotrons, and we'll come back to them in this episode and others. When researchers are working on soil, they have decisions to make about which approach to use. Here's Ziska Veen.
Every approach has its advantage and disadvantage. That's why we also use all of them. We have what we call a soiltron, which is sort of an ecotron, where we actually collected intact soil cores of 1 meter diameter. So they're really big mesocosms, basically, with intact soil layering. We brought them all here from the Netherlands, so we have 60 from the most abundant soil types, and now we do all kinds of manipulations and measurements on them. So they're a bit sort of our eco.
60? 60,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's quite impressive. So we had like, Wim has it, so when you talk to him, you can ask for it, but there, we have these like little films or and photos of like, it's a super big soil drill with a crane that like takes it up.
Oh, what you're saying, take it intact, in other words, so you have those layers. Ah, well.
Yeah, like intact. Mm-hmm. Then you have those layers. But that's huge effort, because if you want to do that for, it's 1 square meter. If you want to drill that into the soil, you cannot do that by hand. And you need a big truck to transport that soil. So yeah. So that's one of the things we have, which is sort of our ecotron, but we call it a soiltron, because it's really on soils. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to the soiltron in a moment. I just want to add Wim van der Putten in here, who talks about the cycling between scales.
What we do as ecologists is we make observations in the field and then we try to explain those, but you can't just explain them from the field only, because the field is too complex. So that's why we try to get things out of the field by soil samples, for example. Then we bring them to the lab, examine them. Then we test certain detailed treatment effects, for example, of nitrogen or temperature or drought in a greenhouse or in something which is semi-controlled, like an outdoor experiment. Then we make conclusions about that. Then we try to put that together. So we go to the field again, see if it works. If it doesn't work completely, then we just go back to the greenhouse and to the lab. So we try to go through this circle from field to lab, greenhouse, and then back to the field. And by that, it's sort of like an action process. We try to improve our understanding. And every time we develop new ideas, we test those ideas. And that's how we bring about progress in this field.
Not all soil ecologists work this way.
There are people who only focus on the lab. There are people who only focus on the field. In the field, what you can do is you can find correlations. You can see patterns. In the lab, you can test these patterns. But what usually is done in the lab is that things are made so unnatural that you don't understand how the real world works. For example, if you test how a plant is affected by one microbe that you have cultured on petri dishes, and then you put that microbe in the soil under otherwise sterile conditions, then you can test how that microbe is interacting with the plant. But if you take a teaspoon of soil, there are 5,000 species of these microbes in it. and even 10 billion individuals, so as many as people on Earth. And what we ultimately want to know is how this one microbe is affecting plants in this consortium of these 4,999 others. And that is what you cannot do in the lab because it takes too much time. So you can just test one microbe, then two, then three, then four. You will not have enough in one life just to test all these possible combinations.
In some experiments, one might inoculate a soil sample and see what happens. Researchers might add one factor, one variable, and then assess the difference it makes. There is fascinating interaction between plants and fungi in their roots. Toby Kears works on this, and I did a story about some of her work and this subject more generally. The link is in the show notes. I just mention her because Wim van der Putten mentions her.
Yes, the common thing there is that you add something. So that's to inoculate. So what people do so they can add one microbe. For example, a lot of work on mycorrhizal fungi, which are fungi that act in symbiosis with plants. In that work, a lot of experiments have been done with one plant, one mycorrhizal fungus, and then see how that works. And you had an interesting piece about Toby Kears, her work, and she looks at how different sort of mycorrhizal fungi are trading off with plants, and then the plant is sort of trying to go for the best offer. That already is just looking at how different microbes perform or behave in relation to this one plant individual. We just take it one step or a major step further. We take this whole handful of soils, where there are all the thousands of species of microbes, and then we add that to plants, and then see how those microbes are influencing the performance of plants. And preferably if you put the plants in a plant community. And then you are quite far towards the field situation. And by doing that, we have shown that, for example, we can enhance the rate of nature restoration by just bringing in the whole soil community, the whole community of bacteria and fungi and everything which is in the soil from a site that has been restored already. And if you bring that into a sort of virgin soil or heavily disturbed soil, you can see that you not only can speed up the process of nature restoration, but you can also drive it into a certain direction.
Iteration is key also to assess what might be happening. It might seem that something can work well in the field, but you have to test that.
Exactly, yes. And the proof is in eating the pudding. So ultimately, you have to try it out under as realistic conditions as possible and then see if your ideas are still correct.
Back to the Soiltron they have set up. It sounds like it might be a resource others might want to try out too. For now, the Soiltron is for their scientists only. But collaborators will eventually be able to come, visit, and work at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. Here's Siska Veen and Wim van der Putten.
Yeah, I think we're always open to this. We just started it. So at the moment, it's affiliated to project. So at the moment, we have our own people working on it. But yeah, I think this is a bit how science works. Like if someone knocks on our door, we're always open to listen and talk and collaborate. Yeah.
First, we want to have it fully established. And then, of course, we can say, well, people are invited to come over and do some work, especially if they have a specialism which we don't have.
One study I had come across was one by Yanji Liu and team from the Northeast Institute of Geography and Agroecology of the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Changchun, China. Siska Veen had handled that paper, which was published in the journal Functional Ecology. The scientists did experiments in greenhouse pots and in field tests. The study by the Liu lab focused on drought, but also on rewetting, which often follows natural drought. The rain does come eventually. The scientists looked at invasive species and drought. So it turns out Yanji Liu and team found that invasive species are hit harder by drought, but these invasive species recover faster than native plants when the rain comes after the drought. I found that surprising, but I guess it goes to show you have to look at an ecosystem for a longer time, otherwise you might draw wrong conclusions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. This is one example, but that's for a lot of things. And of course, this is challenging because, let's say, in the Netherlands, for example, we also have huge issues with nutrient deposition. Let's say you would only look at drought, but don't include the extra nutrients. You might also draw wrong conclusions on what's going to happen in the future.
Nutrient deposition is not fertilizer, yes or yes or no? Or...
Yeah, it's coming from fertilizers and from industry and cars, and there's lots of reasons. And I don't know if you heard about it, but it's like a huge crisis that we're going through at the moment. Also, Belgium is in it. We have a lot of super intensive agriculture. We're both very small countries. Nature's really suffering. I mean, like really suffering. So let's say in these systems, if you would not think...
Meaning suffering, just so I know, so the soils are depleted, but also the farmers are...
Yeah, acidifying, and then forests are dying because of that. Yeah, like there's all kinds of examples. So maybe it's too much to go into it, but like, for example, birds or eggs, they don't have enough calcium anymore. So the eggs and the bones of birds, they get very fragile, so they can just break, basically, like those kind of things. So yeah, so there's a huge, from the European Union, there's a huge sort of task put on us to reduce that. But of course, it affects a whole ecosystem. So if you want to understand how global change is impacting on ecosystem, you actually also have to look at that factor. There's multiple other factors like warming, extra CO2. And I think just realizing that all these factors are influencing the impact of the other factor. That's indeed what you basically got from this paper. That's really important. But it also is good to realize that you cannot usually study all of it at the same time. So we realize that we actually cannot draw maybe all the conclusions all the time. And we also realize that we need to study more of these multi-factors together. But that's also really challenging, because you can understand, like, if you add one factor, it doubles your setup, basically. But if you add another one, and you also want to look at all the crosses, it's sort of an exponential curve, right? It's not just only doubling all the time. It, like, yeah, exponentially increases the number of samples that you have to take. So this is a challenge for the field.
In an experiment, scientists need numbers and also controls. Let's say they're looking at one or several factors. They need to do this multiple times and have something to compare it to benchmark it to.
So this is a challenge. And we all know that. And that's also why experiments in a way are powerful, because you're manipulating one experiment, one factor at a time. But sometimes you know that a factor is dependent on the other one. And this is what, basically what you also got from that paper, right? So if you only look at drought, but don't look at what happens after re-wetting, you don't really know the full story. It's also a time issue to that, right? It also depends on if you're interested in what happens right after drought. Yeah, measuring immediately is fine, but if you're interested in long-term effects, you might need to look at re-wetting. Yeah.
To look at long-term effects of drought, one would need to consider what happens when the rain does eventually come, and that means the experiment runs longer and will cost more. I wondered what types of interactions she and her colleagues had with policymakers. There must be pressure on them to establish what is happening to the soil, and people must be asking, what can we do to fix this, like now?
Yeah, this is a very good question. It's also a bit different and depending on your own personality, I think, as a scientist. So scientists are always a bit careful. Sometimes maybe too careful, because we know everything's context dependent, and so we want to do more research in more context. And yet at the same time, indeed, people need to fix problems now. How should I phrase this? So I think there's a few things that I would like to say about this. One is, we actually don't know everything for sure, but we do have a lot of knowledge already. So one is, we try to communicate that knowledge, but it's of course partly not up to us. We can communicate what we need to do, but then doing it isn't something different, right? And that involves a lot of more sort of social sciences, I think. So we are communicating what we know, and we hope that helps to solve some problems now. So that's one thing. We already know a lot. I think the second thing is that we already know a lot, but of course we don't know everything. So in the meantime, while communicating what we know, we go on with these experiments. And there's always something more to do, but that doesn't mean that we cannot communicate what we already know. So I think that should go hand in hand all the time. And even, I think there's never an end to, let's say, science, because every time we find out something, we also find more questions or unknowns, right? So I think this process always has to go hand in hand. We should always communicate what we know. We should also always continue finding out more. I think what we do see in our research is that we're shifting a little bit the focus for, so already in my lifetime as a scientist, I see that when I started, we were more focused on understanding what was happening. And now we're also more focused on steering our systems and understanding how we should do that. And that's, of course, much more of much more immediate relevance to, let's say, policymakers or end users of knowledge.
Before delving more into policy, let's go back to the Soiltron for a moment, back to the soil ecotron at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. This way of doing experiments lets scientists study soil and more factors that influence soil. Here's Wim van der Putten.
What we soil ecologists are being accused of by soil physicists and chemists is that we take soil, we just mix it, and then we put all kinds of things in. So, and they are right, because soil has different layers and has gradients and so. So what we did in the soil ecotron, we just made steel cylinders, and we sort of drilled these cylinders, or we have turned them into the soil with a hydraulic crane. And so we just had a soil, a meadow, and then we just put in these cylinders, and then we just dug a trench next to the cylinders. We pulled them on a steel plate, and that's how we dragged them out and brought them to the institute here. So we have soil. It's like bringing an ice core to your research station. And so we have all the structures, all the layers, the stratification, everything is intact. And then we brought them to the institute. Well, we could have examined them in the field as well. There's two problems there. So one is that in the field, these cores would be as leak as it can be. So everything can escape in every direction. And the other thing is that some of these fields are really remote. So if you want to do regular gas production measurements like CO2 coming out of the soil, then we had to go to these fields every week. And now we can just have our high-tech equipment to measure all these different fluxes and flows. And we just have them in one experiment, and that makes it easier.
The Soil Ecotron has been up and running for a few years. It's a way to model the different soils and see how certain types of soil damage and depletion might be addressed.
We know from other Ecotron type of experiments, so outdoor experiments or field experiments, that to set up these treatments can take 5 years easily. And this is what we don't know. Why? Why does it take so much time before we get this more diverse soil community established? Is it that some of these species are there, but they have to be waked up, or do they have to become in higher numbers, and that does take time? So this is what we don't know. This is what we can investigate.
The Ecotron mirrors the soil types in the Netherlands and their damage.
Okay, so we have the three main types of soil in the Netherlands, which is clay, sand, and peat. And of each main soil type, we have 20. So we always want to have 5 replicates, so then we can have 4 treatments. And 4 treatments, yeah, you can have 2 of one and 2 of the other treatment. And for example, so we took these soil cores, soil columns, from fields that were heavily managed grasslands. And we know that in these heavily managed grasslands that you get less soil biodiversity than if you go more to a semi-natural grass. And they are heavily manured, and often also they are just plowed down and re-sown with grasses, and maybe also being sprayed with herbicides. These treatments have a negative effect on soil biodiversity. So what you then see is that you're losing out the bigger guys in the soil, and you're also losing out the fungi in the soil. So what we did with these columns and with these ecotrons, we have added or inoculated live soil from more natural grasslands to bring in, to restore the natural soil biodiversity in these systems. And then as another treatment, we have sown a more diverse mixture of plants, of grass species and forbs. So we created actually very high intensive cores. We created the most extreme soil cores with more diverse soil community and more diverse plant community. And then also we have the two combinations. So we have the combination intensive grassland with more soil biodiversity, and we have intensive grassland with more plant species. So we set up these experiments, and then when time is ripe, we have students starting to work on them. What we also do is use gradients in the field. So fields that have been restored 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, but also 10 years, 20 years. And then we can sample such a gradient, which is what we call a chrono sequence, so a time series. And then we have these gradients and we can sample them in one day. And it is like if you are going through time, so through 30 years time, in one day.
Because soil changes over time due to many factors, one needs that view of change over time. Here, Wim van der Putten talks about a collaborative mesocosm experiment, a medium-sized equitron, which is set up in 2012, and that has been running since then.
So we have established that experiment in 2012, and it has been running for a number of years. And, for example, there has been a Chinese guest researcher doing work in it. And 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago, we had a PhD thesis defense of a Chinese PhD student. She got here with a Chinese scholarship. And then we said, okay, we have this experiment, and let's do your work in this experiment. And then she collected data. So now we have this experiment where just different people have been doing their PhD or their guest research period in. And then every time we get new results that we can put together in the end, but also these people can just do their work in a running experiment, which has quite a history.
Soil change is also due to our not-so-great influences on soil. Ecology as a science changes due to the changes in soil, and more generally, it changes due to many other factors. The field of ecology changes as the approaches to study ecology change. It used to be, for instance, about assessing which species are in a given environment. But soil has complexities. There are chemical and physical characteristics. There are organisms to track, many insects and microbes living in soil. So there are techniques that help researchers understand who's there and which organisms are using which resources in the soil. And as Siska Vein explains, there are techniques she wishes were no longer ones she and other researchers can only dream about.
So if we look at like ecology in general in the past, what we've done, let's talk about plant communities, for example. We've like met the species that were there, how abundant were they, and all these things. You can see them easily, right? So, but that's like decades ago. We've moved on from there to understand like what drives these species, how are these communities assembled, who's interacting with whom, what are the mechanisms underlying all of these assemblies of communities and all of the composition of communities and what they do. That's sort of easy because you can see those communities. It has been hugely complex, but it's relatively easy. I think in the soil, we're like 50 to 100 years behind, because now with all these metagenomic techniques, we're only basically mapping species. We're still at the stage of like who's there. So I think for me, what I'm increasingly interested in, but I'm not a methodsy person, so that's actually interesting. In like, I'm not like the one that's inventing cool new methods in the lab. But what we're increasingly using, and what is super exciting, I think, is tracing elements in the soil so that we can actually see who is doing what. So we're like, yeah, following this movement in ecology above ground, basically. So not only seeing who's there, but what are they actually doing? Because for me, that in the end is the most interesting part. And there we need these sort of more high-tech methods for where we can actually trace interactions between species, where we can trace elements in the soil. Let's say carbon, for example. If we want to understand what carbon from above ground is actually going to the soil and staying there, we might need to trace it because we can, yeah, we cannot see otherwise where it's coming from. So there are like, for example, stable isotopes that we can use for that. And then in combination with these metagenomics techniques, the who's there techniques, let's say, then you get really cool information on like who's actually using some of the resources you're giving and what are they doing with it and what is lost as a gas and what is staying in the soil. What's lost as a greenhouse gas, what is staying in the soil as organic matter and is stored for a longer time. What is staying in the soil as a nutrient for plants, what is lost as an N2O gas, like a nitrous oxide, which is a very potent greenhouse gas. So those kind of questions, I think, like that tracing of these elements is really interesting, also for fundamental understanding of these systems. So that's one thing. I think the other thing, what we're increasingly thinking about, and we don't really, well, there's two things that we're increasingly thinking about. We don't have the techniques yet, but that would be great tools to have, is sort of in situ continuous measurements of important processes or soil biodiversity or whatever. So we, yeah, let's say one thing that we can measure very easily now and that we do, for example, above ground is like air temperature. And it helps us, you know, to predict the weather, to predict, I don't know, all kinds of things. In the soil, we can also measure temperature, but there's all kinds of other things that we cannot measure easily. And that would be super nice to have this sort of continuous measurement so that we're in line with like weather forecasts, can try to understand and forecast what's happening in the soil in real time. Yeah, in a real time way, in a real context way. And that's not there yet, but that's something we're dreaming about a lot. So, yeah.
This dream of assessing soil changes in real time, right as they are happening, seems practical and important. It might also involve temperature changes and many other aspects. I asked Siska Veen more about this.
Yeah, which is going beyond temperature, basically. But we would like to measure things like carbon flows or like, yeah. They also refer to it sometimes as lab on a chip, where you in the field take like, it's a bit of a different scale, but you take like a sample, put it on a chip, and then you see like who's there, for example. So to not have to do all this metagenomics, like those kind of tools, or like have continuous measurements indeed of some, yeah, I don't know, carbon fluxes or whatever. That would be all super cool. We can do a little bit of it, but it's all super specific and really expensive, and it does like one measurement at a time. But like having something that in situ measures, yeah, like sensors, basically, that's what we're looking for a lot. Because now it's very labor intensive to do all these measurements on soils, and you always have to take them out of their context into a lab, and that's not always the same.
One issue I wondered about, also considering how labor intensive studying soil is data sharing. I come across data sharing issues a lot in my reporting, and the practices differ widely between fields.
Yeah, so at the moment, I think this is all really under development, and we're all aware that we need to be much more open, but open science is not, we're not there yet, for sure. So there's indeed, like, now if you publish a paper, you usually publish the data with it. So all these repositories that have links to papers, those data you can find there. But the sort of reality still is that if you're doing a meta-analysis or you want to fill your model, you have to actually contact a lot of authors to get the data. So that's what we're doing a lot.
All too many papers have a note that says data available upon request. Sometimes, maybe, quite often in some fields, the data are not readily available upon request. For soil, there are a lot of resources where researchers can find data. Links to the ones that Siska Veen mentions are in the show transcript.
There's a few initiatives that create like these, let's say, data layers for like GIS type of analyses, these global maps, and more data go into that. So there's someone, Tom Crowther, I don't know if you know him, he's leading a lot of those initiatives. There's a group in Belgium, they work on it too. Jonas Lembrechts is the name. But there's also in Wageningen University, I don't know if you know Wageningen University, it's in the Netherlands. It's like big in soils. It's like, right, if I look out of the window, I see it. We're on the same campus. But they have like something that's called ISRIC, which is the International Center for, well, soil something. They store soils, and they also have databases, for example, on major like pH, organic matter, some of those sort of major things that everybody always measures. So there's some initiatives where they try to put this together. We at the NEO are building something that, and that's not yet available, but that's going to be available soon, but something that's called the Reference Center for Soils, where we also are basically collecting all kinds of soil biodiversity measurements on as many soils as we can get our hands on. So we have a big project ourselves where we measure already 1,000 soils, but we hope to, at the end, fill that reference center with more soils so that we can sort of benchmark also like what is a good soil, but all those data that are in such a place at some point should be open. So there's a lot of those initiatives. This is only a handful, but I mean, there's more people that do this. And yeah, this will all be open at some point. There's also the initiatives like GBIF. I don't know if you know that. It's like the biodiversity databases. That is international, actually. And like NETSOP, it's the FAO has like a network on soil biodiversity. It's called NETSOP, Network Soil Biodiversity. Like those kind of things. They're all yet startups, let's say. So none of them has a lot of data on soils in it at the moment. But everybody agrees that we should do this. And yeah, in a few years, it will be there. Yeah, now you still have to contact everybody for everything.
As is true in many areas of research, policymaking shapes the science. For soil, there was something called the Soil Directive, and it leads to a need to have comparable measurements and discussion about soil health. Soil can be healthy and yet environmentally be problematic. And I apologize here, for some reason we had some disturbance in the audio all of a sudden.
Yeah, the Soil Directive, this is the thing that has been established in 2016. Before that time, in 2006, they tried to establish a soils directives already, a directive already. So a directive is not a law, but it's sort of an intention. And in the earlier version, there were five countries which were against. Unfortunately, it was also the Netherlands, but also Germany, France, the UK, which was still part of the EU then, and Austria. So against, yes. And you wonder why, because the Netherlands is just a frontrunner in soil research. But that's where the politics comes in. People are afraid that if, so the story was that we have our soil legislation so well organized that we don't want to go back to the ones who have it least organized in Europe. But actually, the key problem was that the Soils Directive would show that in the Netherlands, things are also not so good as that we claim that it is. So, but that's gone now. So now we have a Soils Directive. And now this summer, the EU law on soil health is being presented in the EU Parliament. And now then it will be sent out for consultation to the member states. There will be a lot of discussion about it. And then in some time, and it might take a couple of years, then this law should be approved, should be voted for, and then we have the EU soil law. And when we have that, then the member states have to maintain the law as well. So the question is how to do that, and what is soil health, and how to measure that. So in soil, we have two types of concepts. One is soil quality. And soil quality was usually used to express the capacity of a soil to produce yield of crops. But actually, you can have a soil of a high quality, which is just leaking greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, leaking nitrate to the groundwater, which gets flooded if you have a rainfall, of which needs to get water if it's a drought period. So those soils which have a high quality for producing yield have a low health, because they don't produce many other ecosystem services. And so this new soil law is looking at soils in a much more holistic way. So not only for producing yield, but also for controlling climate, for controlling the quality of our surface water, of the groundwater, for water buffering capacity, and so on and so on.
Having a soil law could be useful in some ways, but it brings up other issues quickly, namely a need to be able to measure soil health if the directive is approved. Beyond laws and rules of various kinds, the EU sets up different ways of assessing soil. One project involves something called lighthouse farms. And then there are living labs. Vin van der Putten explains.
The European Commission has a number of missions. So we have the mission Soil Health and Food. And that mission is responsible for all the soil knowledge in the EU. And they proposed to set up 100 lighthouse farms and living labs across Europe. So what's a lighthouse farm? A lighthouse farm is something which is a farm where they just have all kinds of novel methodologies to produce crops in a more sustainable way. That's where you can learn. A living lab is much bigger. It's, for example, an area of 50 by 50 kilometers, where not only farmers are there, but also the people in villages or cities, but also the people who sell something to farmers or who buy products from farmers. And so this whole community is influenced by the health of soils, but also it's influencing the health of soils by all kinds of social interactions, economy, legal procedures, social aspects, whatever. So in a living lab, the EU wants to find out not only what are the best technical solutions, but also what are the best technical and socially acceptable solutions. And that's the interesting thing of the living labs approach of the EU. And so this is also what we are trying to roll out internationally. So we had meetings of EU with Canada and EU with the United States. And for example, the Canadians said, oh, we like this living lab approach and lighthouse farm approach, or maybe we could also develop them in Canada. And actually, this is something that the Food and Agriculture Organization, the FAO, in Rome is doing. So the United Nations has given them a task, improve the health of soils worldwide. So they also think about, can we set up these living labs or lighthouse farms across the world where we are constantly going to monitor effects of what we do on soil biodiversity and the ecosystem services that it provides, and therefore get a more constant and direct type of monitoring of the environment.
These are large-scale, soil-focused programs that pull in all sorts of other aspects, economic and social ones too, to gauge soil health and sustainability. This topic brought us back to the science paper he and colleagues authored, which is about calling for a global approach to soil health.
And so and the point that we made in our science perspectives is that the EU can take care of the health of its own soils, but it should also take care of the health of the soils elsewhere. So we have a footprint. And so if we just take care of the health of soils in Europe, but then we export the need to produce a lot of food and feed to other countries, then we still have a negative footprint on soils in other regions in the world. And this is what should also be prevented by good and solid EU policy.
Since we were talking about soil and food production, I thought I might ask Wim van der Putten for soil expertise related to gardening. Do you rake the leaves away from your garden patch? Well, Wim van der Putten has some comments on that.
Yeah, so it's important to take care for the organic matter in soil. So what many people do is they remove the leaves, even bring them away, and then they buy fertilizer to fertilize the soil. So the best is to go for a system as circular as possible. So rule one is to manage your soil organic matter properly. Put on organic matter, leaves, whatever, compost. Prepare your own compost and put it on your land.
Another aspect to think about is about how microbes and fungi play crucial roles in soil health. Fungi have, let's say, interesting appetites that matter a lot in soil health.
Yeah, this is interesting. Usually the bacteria are more or less at the same level, and the fungi can go up or down. So if you look at the fungal to bacterial ratios, then usually it's the fungi that vary. So, and it's important to have enough fungi. And in order to get enough fungi, it's important not to till your soil too much. So that's why no-till is better than just till. So don't just disturb the soil too much. There is a bit of trade-off, because most food crops are originating from wild plants that like to grow in disturbed soil. So you have to disturb the soil to some extent, but try to do it as minimal as possible. And then put organic matter on, which is preferred by fungi because they like the slow food more than the fast food. So put slow food for the soil organisms on your soil, and you will get more fungi. Also in combination with not just tilling the soil too much. That's basically it.
Interest in the role of microbes in soil research and thinking politically about soil have changed a lot over the course of his career, says Wim van der Putten. Although there is name-calling, too, In Dutch, some people who are too holistic about soil are called woolly socks people.
It's interesting to see soil has become really hot over the past decades. And when I started out, I showed that in nature, soil pathogens influence the changes in plant community composition. In the beginning, people said, we don't believe this, we don't buy this. Now this is common good for many plant ecologists. Over time, we just went more towards the whole soil. The risk is a little bit that people consider, people who think from a holistic perspective, as a bit like what we say, this woolen socks people. People with alternative ideas and so on. But actually, for the quality of our life, it's really important that we just look at soil from a holistic perspective, because this is giving soils which take less management, they give more functions in return and more services. So actually, we're just fools if we don't use these soils in a proper way. And the trick will be to make people aware of that just looking at soil from this all-inclusive perspective is cool rather than something else.
That was Conversations with Scientists. Today's episode was with Dr. Siska Veen, soil and ecosystems researcher at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology, and Dr. Wim van der Putten, who heads terrestrial ecology at the Netherlands Institute of Ecology. The music used in this podcast is Jungle Jam by Everett Z and licensed from artlist.io. And I just wanted to say, because there's confusion about these things sometimes, the scientists in this podcast and the Netherlands Institute of Ecology didn't pay to be in this podcast or pay for this podcast. This is independent journalism that I produce in my living room. I'm Vivian Marks. Thanks for listening.